My name is Scott East, as I was just introduced. I'm lucky enough to be the PhD student that's been involved in this very large project. And my broader PhD project is looking to rethink the relationship between museums and the future in a very broad sense. So I kind of stepped away from the climate change angle a little bit, and thinking back to Mike's very inspirational talk this morning, my talk definitely tries to look at the way our future imaginaries are structured. Obviously, in a world facing climate change, it seems as if the future is everywhere. Leaders want us to move forward together towards it. Construction companies promise they can build the future. Finances can secure your future. And seemingly everything needs to be justified in reference to it. Predictions, models, forecasts, updated, uploaded, overloaded. There is no escaping it. The future is approaching from every angle. So much so that on the weekend, the Bishop of London even managed to mention it 5 times in his short sermon for the royal wedding. It seems even he's interested in creative futures. Amongst this contemporary fixation with the future, the question remains, how can we represent such futures, which of course, by their very definition, don't yet exist? This, of course, represents difficult ground for museums. While they've always been concerned with the future, as Fiona pointed out this morning, they don't necessarily have a tradition of engaging with the future as much as they do other issues of social change. So what I thought I'd do today is look at an institution that has a far greater history of engaging the future, and that's the World Fairs and World Expositions. They've been a site from their very beginnings with the Great Exhibition of 1851, where the world has come together to consider and display future imaginaries. With many world firsts, such as the telephone, photograph, typewriters, electric lighting, ice machines, as well as the first words to be publicly broadcast by a public leader on radio, have been exhibited. And last year's Shanghai World Expo was no different. Although rather than specific technological firsts, getting their first airing, of course, inventions such as smartphones and tablets find the international media cycles and social media more appropriate launches than the 5-year cycles of world fairs. So what futures were evoked at the expo and how were they represented? One thing was clear, the theme was better city, better life. And it took space on the edge of the city of Shanghai on the river, and a 5.2 kilometre space was cleared for these massive displays. So it self-consciously evoked the future, and it's the basis of my reflections today. The future that is invoked by the English translated theme with its reputation of better evokes a future that is greater, higher in quality and healthier than before, than our present. This hopeful future seems strangely at odds for an age where we're accustomed to fearing the worst. The theme was interpreted in various ways in individual, national and commercial theme pavilions. For those of you who haven't seen this map, the bottom side of the map is predominantly where all the national pavilions were hosted, as well as the very large centrepiece of the China Pavilion. Right next to that China Pavilion is the massive complex of theme pavilions. Every expo has a set theme and that they display, and that's one of the ones I'm going to focus on. And the upper end of the river there were mainly the corporate pavilions as well as an urban best practice area. But, you know, keeping with my imaginative take on the expo, what I want to focus on first is the thing that struck me in the way that this better future was evoked for us was the way that a number of motifs become repeated again and again and again. The first one was clocks. The clocks had a variety of functions. They became a symbol of our modernity, our shared existence. But it was also about establishing this shared moment of us being on the brink of catastrophe. It was putting us at the edge of crisis. Quite often in the displays, there would be these major clocks that were repeated again and again throughout all of the theme pavilions, at least, and this kind of sound of time ticking away, of which this pendulum is a good example, gave it this example of the world at its edge. Also, the clocks tended to naturalise change as just the experience of every day. And so we'll kind of move on to globes. They seem to be everywhere as well. They kind of establish it, that we're all in it together, of global cooperation, global shelter. Quite often the globes formed a hub that we could all take safety in. Perhaps in some of the space-themed pavilions, that we were just one planet amongst many. The porthole to the Earth, so actually becoming to visualise it. And one of the important things that have been pointed out by commentators that have done visual analysis of the way globes have been employed in environmental discourse is that often the globes can promote thinking of our environment as a separate object. Rather than something that we're immersed in, it becomes this image which problematically reinforces the distance between humans and their environment around environmental issues. So, where am I going? And that this was especially relevant in this display I'm going to talk to in a second, in which you kind of went through the crisis, came out to this kind of vista of the Earth from the safety of a boardwalk. And the other symbol was children. Children were everywhere. As soon as the future was mentioned, out popped the hopeful child in which we have to leave our legacy. So if the globes and clocks are about establishing a common time and space for the crisis, the impending crisis, these visions became embodied in the figure of the child. This symbolically overloaded image of innocence and limited ability establishes the figure of the future as a passive victim which should elicit our care. It places us as the parent of the child, and as such places us in a parental relationship to the not yet. Such that its echoes of my unborn children's voices I am meant to hear rising above the dusty, desolate globe. It's this affirmative character of the child who consistently popped up at the end of displays to provide an inspirational, upbeat conclusion. If the clocks and globes are about evoking planetary crisis and concern, it is for the child that we must collectively act to secure this child's future. So the expo provides a space through the repetition of disaster evoked by globes and clocks in which to perform our concern for the child in the face of this impending catastrophe. What creates this impulse to repeat these three icons in all the various displays evoking the future? Some more kids for you. There's even this one that the future in utero. Quite a favourite display of mine. In order to do that, I want to just take a little bit of backtrack to look at what might be compelling us to repeat this. And this comes back to some of the questions that was earlier. An emphasis, the expos are run by the International Bureau, International Des Expositions, that was established in 1928. It's ratified by 157 member states, of which they maintain the calendar and decide who's going to host this mega world event. The BIE states that their mission as ensuring the integrity and quality of expos so that they may continue to educate the public and promote innovation in the service of human progress. The underpinning logic of human progress is obviously rather problematic in terms of the sustainability theme picked up in the exposition. But I would argue that the explicitly educative mission has the greatest effects on those pavilions that seek to address issues of sustainability. So now I just want to have a couple of images of one case study of how the future was evoked and then the catastrophe shown. So this was from the Urban Planet themed pavilion. It was designed by the German communication agency Triad Berlin, who outbid 150 competitors in order to work with the Chinese authorities to realise this pavilion. The initial stages of the pavilion consist of two sections, a prologue that discusses the urban sprawl and the children of the world. The next stage, which this image is from, is the road to crisis. This is where we consistently saw the kind of time metaphors, the clocks, the pendulums. The area was very lowly lit, with most panels of any the small amounts of text being backlit. And what it tried to evoke was the fact that on a number of fronts, water, our urban populations were facing a crisis. But what are the effects of creating these fearful images? Sarah Ahmed, one of the key theorists of affect or emotion, reminds us that the work of fear and anxiety is that they work to secure social norms in the present. Perhaps not useful when our present social norms are creating the risks. Of course, there's another thing that fear does. Often fear, and this is a quote from her again, fear remains while the objects of fear are displaced, end quote. So in the context of the climate problem, we must remember that the action of creating climate change as an object of fear may simultaneously assist in the displacing of climate change altogether. Too much, let's run away from it. Of course, it famously evoked in the biological or behavioralist binary fight or flight. Of course, these aren't the only responses, and I'll look at another way that this was engaged really quickly. So obviously, impending crisis, doom, 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 fear, fear, fear. Get to see our vista onto the planet, which the designers termed their Eureka moment, in which we come to see the position that the world's actually in. It should be noted, in my thesis, I draw a lot on psychologist Sylvan Tompkins, which is really popular in this strand of cultural theory. And for him, the kind of eureka moment is the resetting emotion. So whenever we transition between emotions, if we're surprised, it gives us a second to reset. So we go from catastrophe onto the surprise. That gives us a moment to kind of change. Another thing about the globes that Tim Ingold has mentioned, that the image of the globes started appearing at that they represent a shift from certainty to a dependence upon the technological fix. It is a movement from revelation to control, from partial knowledges to calculated risk. And as we continue through this display, that's exactly what we get. We go down the road to solutions now, on which the outer boardwalk, a number of technological and social fixes to the catastrophe are delivered, such as eat less meat, you probably can't read it there, plant trees, save water, these kind of things. So we have the image of disaster, we're provided with what's going to solve this, which is usually individual kind of taking action. And then we come in under the globe to see this amazing 360 panorama video called The Only Earth We Have. And much like most of the other pavilions that engaged this kind of discourse of catastrophe, there was this desire to provide an inspirational and fully surround hopeful message. And I think that's really signalled by everybody's upturned heads there in terms of we're looking to the hopeful future ahead. It is my argument that this desire to return people to feeling better in the present ultimately enables a business as usual model. According to the official website, visitors come to understand cities as a source of both problems and solutions. The Pavilion, having raised the urgency of global environmental crisis, then immediately resolves our imprecations by letting us step off in constantly changing revolving planet in order to understand naturalized cycles of change. Another theorist I'm a bit fond of reminds us, Lauren Berland, that shifts in affective atmosphere are obviously not the same as changing the world. And she concludes the drive to feel different, but she does conclude that the drive to feel different can point us to the centrality of optimistic fantasy to surviving in zones of compromised ordinariness. I.e., the need to escape is one way to detect the impossibility of living in the present moment is too much to bear. So when we feel that the truth that we need to present to people is too much to bear, that we have to provide this hopeful future, it should be a bit of a warning signal that maybe we're living in these zones of compromised ordinariness. I will now want to step away from the themed pavilions or any of the government pavilions to look at the way... there's that upturn, just a wedding shot. You can see that hopeful future of the newlyweds found its way in there. I now want to look at the way another pavilion and what they might teach us about environmental futures. It seems a bit odd to look to Coca-Cola to learn how to deal with our environmental futures, but that's exactly what I'm going to do. Feeling better may not be the goal, but it is optimism that connects Coca-Cola to Expo 2010, whose popular pavilion, the Happiness Factory, forms part of their partnership with the event. Glenn Jordan, the group president of Coca-Cola, explains, "It is this refreshingly optimistic view of the world that unites both Coca-Cola and Expo 2010. Both of us share a common vision of creating a brighter and more sustainable future." Shanghai's vice mayor straightforwardly reciprocated, explaining that the signing of Coca-Cola as one of the Expo's global partners symbolises the friendship between China and the US. As Coca-Cola is one of the global partners of the Expo, its products are distributed throughout the site, and only Coca-Cola is, of course, with the cost of a bottle of Coca-Cola being 2 RMB being substantially less than the bottled water of 5 RMB. Reworking the pavilion's theme, "A world refreshed with happiness," we realise, may not mean refreshed with health. So overflowing with optimism, what can the real thing teach us about this infective emotion of happiness and optimism? Indeed, the optimism displayed at Coca-Cola's pavilion appeared qualitatively different from the optimism that was displayed in the rest of Expo, especially the insistent emphasis on hope at the end of Urban Planet. Again, Lauren Berland, a theorist of public affects, discusses optimism has the potential to be cruel when those promises turn out to be essential to what it means to keep on living and to look forward to being in the world, yet impossible or to maintain or just downright toxic. Our carbon addiction, anyone? Indeed, the loss of it threatens to defeat the capacity we have to have hope in anything. So this is her idea of cruel hope or cruel optimism. Which can't be identified by the individual, it needs to be identified by the analyst. Anyway, back to the Coca-Cola Pavilion, it's much more fun. The very popular pavilion, the average queue time over the 3 months of the expo was 7 to 9 hours. After several aborted attempts at queuing, I left my visit for late one evening because I really had to see the Happiness Factory, I really wanted it. And so I queued for 2 hours to get in here. And you could never really tell how long the line was because they wanted people to stay there. Very smart at crowd management. So there's the exhibition, obviously, of Coca-Cola bottles and memorabilia. But the main centrepiece of this is a video, and I'll just indulge you a little bit just to show you a little bit of this film because I really, really liked it. So it kind of tells the story. It formed their mass marketing campaign globally of the Happiness Factory, of which Niles Barkley, Open Happiness Song, is the theme song. Anyway, it tells the story of somebody, what happens when they put the coin into the Coke machine and how the Coke goes about. Coke obviously runs out. Warning bells sound, and our hero here has to step up to meet the challenge. And we see the kind of crisis being invoked. He saves the day, takes it to the king, gets his mission, goes on his merry way, faces all of this kind of terrible destruction, and yeah, guess what? As you'd expect in the Happiness Factory, after all these trials and tribulations, he too is restored to a hopeful and joyous future. So what did I want to take from that? Obviously, Coca-Cola gets to sidestep their moral responsibility of teaching us to live environmentally sustainable futures. But what I really liked about the Happiness Factory movie was the fact that in order to be restored to a hopeful future, we actually had to face the task at hand. Rather than the crisis being evoked and then technological or individual fixes being, you know, immediately presented and we leave the pavilion with our head held high in our hopeful relationship to the future, the character actually needs to face up to the task at hand. So the rest of the bottle's journey is celebrated with much fanfare and to the instrumental version of the recent pop single Open Happiness, written by CeeLo Green with Niles Barkley. And it's copyrighted by Coke. Skip over discussing that song because it's too much fun and this obviously isn't an audience for fun. And we'll just go to just the last pavilion that I wanted to evoke. Obviously, the thing with Coca-Cola in that kind of narrative form is it still tells... there's a lot of narrative closure, obviously, but I think that it can offer some ways of kind of, dealing with the issue rather than that dominant hope-fear thing. One of my favourite novelists, Jeanette Winterson, explains it like this. Imaginative works create emotional situations not dependent on meaning. The meaning is there, separate from its message. It allows the brain to make connections that bypass sense. This makes for an experience where there is a satisfaction of meaning, but also something deeper, stranger. Another one of my favourite theorists, Felix Guattari, talks about this as an auto-enriching process, which constantly works to rupture meaning, suggesting that, and this is a quote, poetry today might have more to teach us than economic science, the human sciences, or psychoanalysis combined. Even poetry made to sell products, desire as want, is available to be ruptured and simply enjoyed. I'm now going to turn very quickly to the last pavilion I want to look at. It's the award-winning UK's Seed Cathedral. Obviously, for everybody at a professional museum capacity here today, you'd be rather jealous compared to the $23 million they had to create this display. So, where were we? Compared to... No, that was the Saudis. So they spent they had a $180 million budget. So, you know, we're talking about big scales here. They also had the numbers equaled that of Coca-Cola, though, which is the interesting thing. Most of the national pavilions, except for Saudi Arabia, struggled to get the kind of nine-hour queues waiting in line. But this centrepiece certainly managed to do that. And what it basically involves is a whole lot of rods that you can see on the outside here that enter into the inside of the cathedral in which seeds are placed. And it's just an absolutely stunning... I think I have some more photos of just the scale of this. So each one of those tubes reflects light from the outside and you see a single seed specimen displayed on the end tips of them. So a really amazing imaginative display. And rather than the kind of head held high optimism that we have, there's people lingering around in there and lots of people bent over, curious to like look at each individual seed, to take notice, to think. And so I think it's another pavilion that really cleverly and creatively sidestepped that kind of hope-fear dichotomy. And obviously, as it's been pointed out to me, the as experiments in the suspension of meaning, this is obviously a risky approach. Obviously, not everyone that visited the UK's Cedar Cathedral got the intended meaning. But I think in its kind of desire to do something different, it allowed different affects to be engaged and different emotions to be considered that maybe were lost in some of the more governmental orientated, we must teach you how to behave as an environmental citizen. So I'll leave it there. Thanks very much for having me.